Session number 13265, reel number 3.
Mr. Marsden, reel 3.
You have to remember that the greatcoat on parade had to be worn with the collar properly hooked up. I don't know what the uniform is like nowadays, but the uniform greatcoat in those days had a collar which closed tightly up to the neck on parade, with two hooks and eyes, so that when it was closed up to the neck, the thing was a really close fit. In addition, on this parade, we had in full kit, we had to have our full webbing on, backpack, side pack, water bottle, the whole thing, and all our gear had to be packed in the kit bag. And so we had to parade in that fashion. It was a hot day, and we went on parade, I suppose, at some time before 1 o'clock. And we were kept on parade, standing at attention, for something like 3 hours. Probably longer. But before 3 hours were up, there were fallers, of course. Chaps fainting and collapsing simply through heat and constriction around the neck and everything else. And Connors refused to allow any relief or ease and so on. When a chap fell, all we could do was pick him up and drag him out onto the grass, lay him down, and then take our place again. And I dare say that there was a fair amount of ill feeling towards Connors about as a result of all that. It's just a minor incident, but it's the kind of stupidity that happens. And Ronald Adams and myself were posted to 145 Squadron, we were told Kenley. The others, I can only remember that Lull Townsend was posted to a Whitley squadron at Driffield. And that night we sat around the our hut, barrack hut was pretty well stripped out. We felt pretty flat, and of course there was the news that the Germans had broken through in France. The phony war had come to an end and things were going to pot at a high rate of knots over there. So we wondered if we'd ever see each other again, you wonder if you're going to make it through, come out the other end. Things like that occur. And the following day, Adams and myself set off to Kenley to find 145 Squadron. Well, I think the nearest we could get to the station at Kenley was on the underground. I don't know quite where we got to. All I can remember is that there was no transport. There was a hell of a long walk, and mostly uphill, carrying kit bags, till we got to the main gate at Kenley, where of course the question was, who are you and what do you want? And we said 145 Squadron, and the chap on the gate said, well, who are they? We said 145 Squadron, Fighter Squadron, we're posted to them. We showed him our orders. Not here, mate, no 145 Squadron here. So we stand there, and he goes off and takes us in. Then he comes back, takes us in the guard room, and Corporal SP gets on the blower, makes inquiries. No 145 on this station. They aren't coming here, but we think they're at Croydon. So you'd better go to Croydon. Well, I think we walked from Kenley to Croydon carrying our kit bags. We got to Croydon, which was the civil airport, of course. Chap on the gate as a civilian Air Ministry policeman. What do you want? 145 Squadron. You're too late, they've left. But hang on. So he got on the blower and he discovered that there was, in fact, a small party of 145 still there. The squadron had been posted to Filton, and there were some ground crew types collecting stuff off to be taken away the following day. So they put us into one of the empty offices. We were in the Sabina office, and gave us bedboards and trestles. Are you acquainted with bedboards?
Just a board?
Bedboards, two wooden trestles with a made of a wooden foot at each end. Imagine a triangle with a notch in, and the broad base of the triangle sits on the deck, and two of those, and say a piece of about 4 inch by inch sitting in the notch between them, that makes a trestle. Two of those and three planks or boards, 9 inches wide, about an inch thick, between them, and you have a bed. You see? You pick the softest board to go in the middle, and if you're lucky, you have a donkey's breakfast to put on it, straw palliasse, and you make your bed upon it. And by the time you've been in the Air Force a few months and whatnot, that's quite good. You can sleep on that, no problem at all. Because the beds you're used to, the McDonald's, are made of cast iron and steel plate. You're not acquainted with these. You should have one at the museum, you know. That really is a splendid exhibit.
Maybe there is one.
I've not seen one, but that, you know, I'm not seeing one on show, but that you really need, you should have two, so you can really demonstrate. A McDonald bed is 27 inches wide in two halves. The foot half of the bed telescopes into the top half. It's angle iron, no springs. There are casters in some cases, in other cases not, and you simply have to push. And the bed support is about a 4-inch steel plate strap. I would say probably 18-gauge steel. And that's crossed, with gaps, so that it's quite a solid bed base. And on that, of course, you have the famous biscuits. You've heard of the biscuits. Yes. They're about 3 to 4 inches thick, stuffed with choir or horsehair, or both, or whatever. And they're not notoriously soft either. So that when you sleep on one of those, you are in effect sleeping on a fairly solid surface. So that bedboards are not really that much different. And so we slept there overnight, found our way to the canteen, got some breakfast, and found the, I think it was a corporal, 145 chap, who was getting the gear together, and we got hauled into that, put our kit bags in a truck and so on, and there was an old-fashioned Bristol bus, which was the squadron transport. I suppose it had been taken up by the service at the beginning of the war. I can't remember. I think it was one of the old-fashioned type with the access from the middle of the side, with a saloon fore and aft. You've probably never seen one of those. There are three steps going up into the bus, and facing you is a seat for about four people, so that you have a little bay there. And and there's a non-smoke. There used to be a non-smoking section at the front for the lady passengers mostly, and the rear section was for smokers, which was the way they seemed to work on most of the corporation bus services which ran them. And the other item of transport was an old Morris 10 or 12 bullnose open tourer with a canvas top. That was private squadron transport. I think members of the flight had lumped together to buy it for themselves. Probably cost about £10. You could buy a car like that in those days for £10 or £15. And so we loaded everything up. We set off, not to Filton as we thought, but to Tangmere. The aircraft had been down to Filton and so on, and were even now getting ready to come to Tangmere, which was where we were going to be stationed. And that, of course, made everybody's eyes sparkle, because Tangmere was Shangri-La in the Air Force in those days. It was the most desirable station in the whole of the UK.
Why?
Situation. Adjacent to Chichester, which is a nice little town. Adjacent to the coast for yachting and everything else, which the gentlemen of the private flying club, which was the Royal Air Force in those days, you know, used to do. It was very handy for London. And it just was a jolly good station. You know, for commission types or non-commissioned types, it was known as a good station. And I guess the station warrant officer had always been carefully chosen. There were stations where which were known to be not the kind of stations you'd wish to be posted to, because the station warrant officer was full of bull, you know, an ultra-disciplinarian, that kind of thing. Well, Tangmere was known to be a good station. And
can you name the others?
Which others?
The others that had the reputation for bull.
Oh, well, of course, all the training stations. What's the name? Begins with U.
Oh, whereabouts is it?
In London itself.
Oxbridge.
I mean, Oxbridge was regarded with horror. Cardington was, because Cardington was a recruit station. And I found, by experience, that stations which had a name like this seemed to infect the people who were posted there. All the people in orderly rooms and so on such stations, St. Athan later on, they were all the most miserable gits you could ever come across. You know, dyed-in-the-wool bull artists. And so, that, you know, it's not surprising that these places got these bad names. I forget what the proper term was for them, transit stations, transit camps in the Wirral. There were one or two there where people went when they were going to be posted overseas, and where you came when you came back from overseas. Now, they were run by orderly room types and permanent staff who had it made, because they were barrack room stanchions, to use the Navy term. They'd got it well sorted, and they had all the fiddles, had everything running for them, and they weren't about to let ordinary airmen get in their way. The fact that they were supposed to be there to look after airmen going through and coming back, that had nothing to do with it. I can remember, I'll say it now if that matters, coming back from overseas later on, the blankets were filthy. I came to the conclusion that they were running a fiddle on the laundry. They were being paid by the laundry for blankets laundered, but the blankets were never leaving the camp. I picked up more grot when I came back from there than I ever collected in the Solomons, for instance.
You mean disease?
Yes. foot rot and things of that order. Yeah. And grot in the crotch and things of that order. I got through overseas quite nicely. Came back there and collected the lot. Simply because the way the place was run. The officers, you see, were, I can only suggest, were freewheeling. They were letting the station be run by the NCOs. And the NCOs had it made. And they'd all got private little incomes and fiddles from all sorts of things.
Where was that?
West Kirby. And there's another camp nearby. Places like that had a, amongst squadron types, had a terrible bad name. There were the people who were on permanent staff there, regardless of rank, were armoured by their positions. You know, corporals and LACs who were permanent staff there could be insolent to senior NCOs coming back simply because they had them in the palms of their hands. They had their documents. They could even fiddle post, fix postings and so on. You know, they... It was not too clever an arrangement. Anyway, we got to Tangmere and... The aircraft were coming in, and we reported onto the squadron, and found ourselves posted into B flight, 145 squadron. The squadron commander was Dusty Miller, who may still be alive, I think. I have his address. I've not heard of him. Slipping off. Our flight commander was Adrian Boyd, Adrian Hope Boyd, to distinguish him from the other Boyds you'll come across in the Air Force, flight lieutenant, and our flight sergeant was Chiefy Bannister, nicknamed Jesus, although not to his face. He had a marvellous crop of yellow curly hair, golden curly hair, and he had a kind of baby face. He was probably in his 30s, fairly long-serving type, but an absolute gen man as a flight sergeant. He had ground crew operations on a fighter squadron. He had it worked out to a fine art. And we were allocated to, made up into teams of flight mechanic and flight rigger, and given aircraft to be take charge of and so on, and set about the job of learning what hurricanes are all about. For the first fortnight, the squadron was not yet operational. It had recently converted from Blenheims, the Blenheim 1s. Fighters to Hurricanes, and so some of the experienced Blenheim pilots had been posted away to Blenheim squadrons, and replacements had come in who were not, hadn't many hours on Hurricanes, so there was quite a lot to be done. And in the case of B flight, Adrian Boyd said that he was going to have us go through a whole lot of practice work for the next fortnight in order to make sure that the scramble was as quick, as fast as possible, and then the turnaround would be as quick as possible. And so we had the job of trying to get the whole flight started up and off the ground in the shortest possible time. So we went through the whole routine. Pilots in crew room with their own parachutes. This is where the parachute myth comes back again in a way. we had a dummy alarm scramble, and so the pilots come galloping out to the aircraft, and the flight mechanic is, or the rigger, whichever one takes the turn, up on the wing, helps the pilot in the cockpit, helps him strap in something, harness and everything else. Pilot starts up, and chap on the deck on the starter trolley unhooks the starter trolley cable, closes up, oxygen turned on, and side panel on the Hurricane replaced, and right, signal then to get away, and that's stopwatched. Oh, and I think it must have been something like 4.5 minutes. And boy, it didn't exactly dance up and down, but it wasn't at all what he wanted. And he got out a blackboard, a needle, and had the whole flight, pilots and ground crew, around it, and drew a diagram showing the channel. Germans over here, and over here is England, and so on, and Trestle Tower, which is the RDF tower. Point, and gave us the whole score with regard to detection by RDF. It could only detect the enemy aircraft taking off from the other side when they reached this altitude, and they crossed the channel at this kind of speed, and in order to intercept them here, then the Hurricanes have to be off the deck and have enough time to climb to 15,000 feet to there, and that requires them getting off the deck in less than 2 minutes. And so we now know the target time and why. So we go through this routine of scrambling. Instead of the pilot carrying his own parachute out with him, he now tries to, I should have pointed out that initially they ran out those seat packs. They tried to run to the aircraft with 18 or 20 pounds of parachute dangling on their backsides. Which I don't know if you've ever seen film of them doing that. It's the most grotesque affair imaginable. It's ridiculous. So, all right, so we'll try it with the parachute sitting on the tailplane. And the mechanic, initially not the mechanic in the cockpit, we'll have the parachute on the tailplane, you sprint to the aircraft, and you clip your parachute on into the kite, start up, and so on. Not fast enough. So now we have the bright idea, we'll have the mechanic in the cockpit, and he'll start the engine, and the pilot will come out at the same time, clip his parachute on, climb in, get into the cockpit. And it's still not fast enough. And so, against considerable opposition, we will now have the parachute sitting in the bucket seat. There was this theory that if people sat on parachutes too long, the silk would get sticky and they wouldn't open, you see. It's part of the whole myth of the parachute. Well, possibly not so much myth, because the old silk parachutes were not entirely as reliable as the later nylon ones. I suppose because of the nature of the silk itself, or possibly not, I don't know. I was never really clued up, but there certainly was an enormous prejudice with regard to parachutes in those days. Probably because not many people had used them to any great extent in peacetime, and they were regarded as something of a holy, with a capital H, mystery object. And it may well be that the amount of bailing out that took place in wartime tended to soften all these things off considerably. Anyway, we now get the parachute in the bucket seat, which is a great relief to all the mechanics, because if you've ever had to sit in a bucket seat with no parachute in it, you'll see what I mean. It's about so deep, and it's shaped like that with a beaded aluminium edge, and if you sit on the aluminium down here like that with that bead under your knees and you sit there any length of time, it gets, well, boring isn't the word, it gets downright uncomfortable. So we now sit on the parachute, the scramble bell goes, we start the aircraft up, the pilot hurtles across in good sprinting order in his flying kit. We are now out of the cockpit on the wing, pilot drops in, we help him strap in, away, minute and three quarters. And at that point, Boydie decides that as far as B flight is concerned, we're operational. And at that point too, the squadron is sent off every day, the aircraft are sent off every day to Manston and other forward fields like that to operate over Dunkirk. One incident occurs in which I was involved, and Jenkinson, the rigger on the aircraft. The aircraft came back in the evening and Boydie was absolutely boiling, and he got the two of us and really tore us off a strip, got us up on the aircraft and pointed out a tiny speck in the bottom right hand corner of the windscreen. He'd chased it all over France thinking it was an aircraft in the far distance and had the whole flight chasing this speck. And why was the windscreen not perfectly clean? Well, it wasn't perfectly clean because, as we said, we had been unable to get any cleaning material from stores. And this was again one of those fiddles. The cleaning material for aircraft, for the perspex and windscreens, was what do we call it? A gauze material. You know the kind of gauze that you see on, say, sheep, carcass of a sheep, and so on. Butter muslin. Butter muslin and perspex polish. Now, perspex polish is in fact only a good metal polish. You know, whiting in solution, not in solution, but whiting suspended in a suspension or something like Terps or whatever, rather like Brasso. And the people in stores, of course, were using this themselves for polishing their own brasses and so on. Or flogging it out and so on, and so that there was, when ordinary, simple-minded mechanics asked for stuff from stores for cleaning windscreens and so on, and that never was any. So we'd been forced to resort to scrounging up what rags we could and so on. Well, Boydie wasn't too pleased about that. He went storming off to stores, and ever after that there was an adequate supply of the stuff. We had a pilot named Scott, a flight lieutenant. I mechanic for him once or twice. And I had the impression that, I may be entirely wrong, but I had the impression that he couldn't face up to going operational in hurricanes.